Welcome to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Beckett. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. Countries around the world have unleashed some $15 trillion trying to cushion the blow dealt by coronavirus, as many stand on the brink of a recession tipped to be the worst since the 1930s. Debts are projected to climb to nearly 3.5 times the size of the world economy. In the UK, the man in charge of opening the fiscal floodgates is a relative newcomer to politics. A Conservative Chancellor would normally be expected to keep the purse strings tight, but Rishi Sunak has been applauded for launching a massive spending spree aimed at keeping workers in their jobs. But what will happen when the spending grinds to a halt and countries are forced to take a step back and look at their debts? This week we're asking, how will the world pay for COVID-19?
Part 1. The Joy of Debt.
I'm Jonathan Portis. I'm Professor of Economics and Public Policy at King's College London.
Our first expert witness says that ballooning government debts are a natural consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic for two reasons.
The first is because tax revenues will fall.
Company profits are under pressure, unemployment is rising, and people are earning less, so far less tax is making its way into state coffers.
And the second is because governments have put in place various policies to try and limit the damage, to try and stop firms going out of business and too many workers becoming unemployed.
In other words, a lot of money is being spent trying to contain the problem. But, says our expert witness, we should view the borrowings we're building up as money well spent to avoid the alternative, an even greater economic catastrophe.
The rise in debt is very, very much a price worth paying to avoid the long-term damage to our economies that would happen if we let unemployment go out of control or lots and lots of businesses to go bust.
Economists call this long-term damage to the economy scarring. And if we let it happen, it could weaken the foundations for growth in the future.
What we really should be worried about is, though, that it leads to permanent damage to our economies, either because good firms go out of business or people lose their jobs and drift into long-term unemployment. That wouldn't just hit us in the short term. It would hit us in the medium and long term. And let's be clear, that would not be the fault of the virus. That would be because we got policies wrong. There is nothing inherent in the course of the pandemic that means we have to accept that long-term damage to our economies.
This logic, says Professor Portis, is backed up by his calculations.
If we allow this crisis to damage our economy by, say, just 3% permanently, that will cost us at least 10 times as much.
It's impossible to predict precisely what impact a shrinking economy would have. But broadly, Professor Portis is saying it's better to plough in funds now than hold back.
Of course, that doesn't mean that all government debt is good all the time. In particular, if money is spent wastefully or even counterproductively, if you build bridges to nowhere, that simply generates debt with no corresponding economic or social benefit, and there's not a lot of point in doing that.
Governments are still in the first phase of this crisis and throwing billions at just trying to keep their economies ticking over. Professor Portis says the maths will show this is money well spent.
Simply having the level of output 1% higher typically means that tax revenues are higher by a third or a half of 1% of GDP. And in most countries, that's quite a lot of money. It's more than enough money to pay the interest on the sort of debt that might be required to help avert that permanent damage.
There's an important message here. Professor Portis is in effect saying we need to revise our old-fashioned attitudes towards debt.
Government debt isn't in itself a bad thing. What is a bad thing is if government debt becomes unsustainable, either because it's spiraling out of control or because interest rate payments on government debt become too high to be financed through tax revenue. And actually, neither of those things is an immediate risk.
Far from debt posing a risk, Professor Portas warns that the belt tightening that went on after the financial crisis of 2008 to pay down government borrowings often proved counterproductive.
I think what this crisis has demonstrated is that one particular ideology, the view that the best way to prepare for a crisis was to try and reduce your debt and deficit, and if necessary, do that by cutting public services, cutting the health service, cutting the welfare state, that was fundamentally misconceived. You don't build a resilient society or economy by cutting public services, even if it leaves you in a slightly better fiscal position. What will happen after this crisis? I think we've sort of tested the austerity ideology to destruction here. So in current circumstances, the calculus is very clear that borrowing the money to finance programs that will avert long-term damage, that is in itself the plan for paying it off.
This sounds like a green light for governments to borrow as much as they fancy and not worry about the consequences. We certainly can't do that as individuals, and companies have to watch their balance sheets too. So why is it different when the state does it?
Part 2. Big in Japan.
If you invest in something, you're supposed to get something in return with a bigger amount than that you initially invested. That's the whole idea of investment, to induce the economy, induce the industries, induce the corporations.
Our next expert witness is an international economist in Japan.
I'm Seijo Takeshita. I'm a professor at the University of Shizuoka.
Professor Takeshita tells the story of how Japan ended up with a debt mountain nearly 2.5 times the size of its economy.
As you know, we had our boom years in the 60s and the 50s as well, and into the 70s, and then came the oil crisis. But at the same time, the Japanese, I would say, structure was changing quite quickly from growth economy into mature economy. But people refused to see that fact and thought that we should continuously have this growth.
Then in the 90s came the collapse and property prices fell sharply. To keep the economy moving, the government started borrowing money. The problem, says Professor Takeshita, was less the debt, more that the cash was spent on things that didn't themselves make much of a financial return.
So what it ended up doing was, well, continuously putting a lot of money, for example, on infrastructure, where the multiplier to the economy was already low in the late 70s or in the 80s, because basically we already had abundant and also enough infrastructure. But they continued to, for example, spend that money into those areas. So I think the policy was totally wrong in how and where they spent the money. And they continued to do this because obviously the Japanese public, many were very happy about it.
There are echoes here of the warning from Professor Portas in part one. Use borrowed funds wisely. But Professor Takeshita says that Japan didn't.
It was the wrong place at the wrong time. And that came from the past glorious memories of growth Japan experienced in the 50s to the 80s. Those are the bubble days. And, those were the days when we should have and could have made a very good transition. But, you know, like all human beings, when you're at a high, you think you're doing so great and the growth will continue forever. And people try to put the same remedy of those growth era into a mature economy of Japan. Of course, it's not going to work. And that's one of the reasons why we continuously have this, large debt that's starting to mount.
Japan was able to keep piling up the debt because its central bank could keep interest rates at a manageable level. Not just that, even more importantly, Japanese people were willing to keep buying government bonds.
90% of debt is consumed within. In other words, all the Japanese lenders of these bonds or deficits are within Japan. So it's not a problem. Many people are saying that.
The bottom line is, if the government wants to pay some of the debt back, it can tax the Japanese people to help it do that.
what they're suggesting, in my opinion, is that the Japanese bonds will not go bust because eventually the Japanese government can rely on the asset of the Japanese individuals. Now, what it's saying is we can eventually tax you very, very high in order to pay back our debt.
So seemingly, as long as the Japanese are happy to keep buying their government's bonds, things can continue as they are. But there are other things that work in Japan's favour. The government has a strong currency and a powerful central bank. And as we're about to discover, these two things are very important when it comes to government borrowings.
Part 3. Getting creative with currency.
So when you have your own central bank and you're borrowing in your own currency, you can always manage your interest rate. Central bank can always do that.
Our third expert witness is Stephanie Kelton, and she's a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University in New York. Professor Kelton says that when it comes to raising debt, countries who are issuing borrowings in their own currency are, on the face of it, in a very different position to countries trying to raise funds in a foreign currency.
You don't ever have to borrow a currency that you and only you can issue, can create. The U.S. government would never have to borrow the U.S. dollar from anyone in order to be able to spend dollars. British government doesn't need to borrow the pound in order to be able to spend pounds.
Professor Kelton says both these countries regularly choose, however, to raise borrowing rather than creating more money to fund government spending. This is called issuing bonds or selling government securities. And because it's the job of the central bank to set short-term interest rates, governments that have a central bank can, in principle at least, decide the rate of interest they want to pay on their debt.
So it keeps the financing costs, if you like, manageable because you get to set the terms on which you pay interest on the securities that you offer to markets.
But let's just pause here and consider how this works within the Eurozone. 19 states all sharing a currency and therefore one central bank. Member nations, therefore, don't have individual control over how much they pay on their debt. This sounds like trouble.
The real risk here is that when this is over and the Italian government is sitting on debt ratio of 160% or more, that there will be pressure brought to bear on the Italian government by the European institutions, including the ECB, and that the Italian government will be told that it must take draconian steps to reduce deficits and to bring down the debt. In other words, austerity will be imposed on the Italian government. That is the real risk going forward.
The threat of cutbacks looms large, of course, not just for Italy, but the point here is that it is not the Italian government's decision alone how it handles its finances. So much for wealthy, developed countries, but what about the world's poorer nations? Will their central banks be able to help them?
Yeah, well, many, many countries in the developing world are, for one reason or another, not able to enjoy a fully sovereign currency.
What Professor Kelton means here is that poorer countries may well have their own central banks and their own currency, but they can't use that national currency for trading with other nations. There just isn't enough trust around that it will keep its value. So they're forced to raise debts in, for example, US dollars.
They are in positions where they're dependent on developed countries to import to them critical goods and services. They need medicines and technologies. They rely on energy and food from the rest of the world. And it is very often the case that in order to import those things, they have got to earn a currency like the euro or like the US dollar in order to be able to import those things. if part of the problem is that you're dependent on the rest of the world for energy, then you have to work toward becoming energy independent. That could be wind, that could be solar, that could be hydro, depending on what country we're talking about. Food dependence, even desert countries can become food independent, but you have to make investments in things like hydroponics, and you've got to find ways to grow food domestically. So it's not easy for developing countries, and the developed world ought to be helping.
Nations in this position are left more exposed because not only do they have no control over the interest rates they pay on their foreign currency debts, but also the currency exchange rate itself can change.
So that really is the critical point you've hit on. It's, are you borrowing in a currency that you and only you can issue? Then it's a game-changing situation.
Part 4, The Long Goodbye.
A lot of countries are in deep trouble. Some of them are, you know, treading water. But if this continues, they too are going to need help.
Our last expert witness is a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund.
My name is Kenneth Rogoff. I'm a professor of economics at Harvard University.
Professor Rogoff says many developing countries are finding that in addition to battling coronavirus, foreign trade is suffering and that they need urgent and meaningful help from the West.
They need aid and not to be repaying debt. And I think there's a very compelling case for at least having a debt moratorium where they don't have to make repayments, say, for the next year or two, at least on sovereign debt. Much the same way that we're doing for homeowners, for small businesses in many of the advanced economies. They aren't earning anything. They're not really able to pay.
The sudden and brutal interruption of economic activity in the developed world has not just damaged exports of manufactured products. It's also led to a dramatic fall-off in demand for commodities, one in particular.
Any country that's exporting oil is in deep trouble. So Nigeria, South Africa, Ecuador and Latin America, Mexico, countries which are very dependent on oil. The price actually got negative at one point. That's really not meaningful, but it went down from, you know, to something like $10 a barrel at one point when it's hard to remember, but back in 2014, it might have been $140 a barrel. And just before this, it was around 60. There's just a massive collapse in revenues. A country like Mexico is very, very dependent on oil for its government finances. It's the major source of revenue.
The sheer breadth of the crisis has left the institutions trying to coordinate the needs of struggling countries unable to cope with the workload.
There are almost 100 countries asking for relief right now from the International Monetary Fund. Remember, it's more the order of being an arbiter in this than the big lender. And, you know, no more than our hospitals can handle all the virus patients coming in at the same time. That's the whole flattening the curve point. The IMF, the US and British court systems, they can't handle everyone coming in at once either. So there needs to be some bridge to get to the other side, something to buy time. And frankly, we don't even know how this is going to end yet, right? We don't know if this is going to take 5 years to get back to where we started. I think that might be a realistic estimate. There really are going to need to be a lot more restructurings. And even the countries that seem like they're in good shape now won't look that way in a year.
The most direct route to handling this, says Professor Rogoff, is that lender nations take the initiative and negotiate directly with each other.
The key players are the United States and China. The United States is the arbiter of many of the loans through the New York court system. it's very, very important. It doesn't necessarily make the loans, but a lot of them are governed in the, by U.S. law. The Chinese are the most important public lender by a mile. If the United States and China agree on having a moratorium, on providing opportunities to give aid, it will happen. I think the rest of the world, especially Europe, will very quickly agree to this.
I just want to come back to China and the U.S. Any agreement to write off debts or a moratorium on debt repayments has to involve the U.S. and China, and yet relations between those two countries are at a low.
You know, in international relations, countries can be foes in one area, but allies in another. And I think they have a common interest here. China needs the developing world in order to get the commodities that it needs, in order to have future markets for its exports. The United States has much the same incentives. Everyone needs global stability.
This takes us back to where we started. Money spent now, debts written off now, can be seen as an investment for the future.
It is massively in the interests of advanced countries, developed economies, to support the developing world at this juncture. There are health reasons. If the developing world doesn't recover, it's harder for the developed world to protect itself from the virus. There are moral reasons. And also just the future of global stability and stabilization.
This turns debt forgiveness from a sunk cost into a type of insurance. And we know how much it would cost because the International Monetary Fund has calculated it for us. $2.5 trillion. A lot of money, to be sure, but still less than twice the total amount of student loans in the United States that some Democrats have suggested writing off altogether.
That's just for a few students in the United States by comparison to 6 billion people in emerging markets in the developing economy. So, I mean, the orders of magnitude are small, but this is an extraordinary humanitarian crisis. And I suspect more will be forthcoming than you might imagine.
For as long as anyone can remember, governments around the world have been warned not to allow their national debt to balloon if they want to guard against a future crisis. But now, just about every government is spending sums that would have lit red danger buttons but a few months ago. Most governments will need to borrow a lot of money. How will the world pay for COVID-19? Well, perhaps the answer we're coming to is maybe we never will. At least, certainly not anytime soon. This edition of The Inquiry was presented by me, Tanya Beckett. It was produced in London by Bob Howard.
Summer 1940. Adolf Hitler was poised to invade Britain. German bombers struck British factories, airfields, towns and cities.
You could hear this wom, 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 wom.
Stopping the onslaught took a very special plane. The best fighter plane in the world. The Spitfire. Before a plane could save a country, the people had to build it.
The enemy is making preparations for the invasion of Britain. How are we going to meet and overcome this danger?
The plane would be assembled in the communities it was designed to protect. Towns and villages were new Spitfire factories. The planes built by a fresh generation of young men and women. This is the story of the people who built the plane that won the war. Spitfire, the people's plane. A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Spitfire, the People's Plane, wherever you get your podcasts.